Mom deserves the best, and there's no better place to shop for Mother's Day than Whole Foods Market. They're your destination for unbeatable savings, from premium gifts to show-stopping flowers and irresistible desserts. Start by saving 33% with Prime on all body care and candles. Then get a 15-stem bunch of tulips for just $9.99 each with Prime. Round out Mom's menu with festive rosé, irresistible berry chantilly cake, and more special treats. Come celebrate Mother's Day at Whole Foods Market.
Hello and welcome to another episode of Pod's Own Country, the Yorkshire Post political podcast. I'm Chris Byrne, the Yorkshire Post political editor, and today I'm joined by Jonathan Ashworth, the Shadow Secretary of State for Work and Pensions. We're here today in person in Sheffield as Jonathan has been up in Yorkshire meeting pensioners to hear a little bit more about kind of how the cost of living crisis has been affecting them. So Jonathan, could you tell me a little bit more about your visit here to this wonderful facility, Parson Cross Forum? And also what you've learned from the people you've been speaking to today.
Of course, and can I start by saying I'm absolutely thrilled to be on Pod's Own Country, Britain's leading political podcast, no less. And I'm here in Sheffield today. We're at a memory cafe. That's a community facility to support those who've got a diagnosis of dementia. And we've been singing some wonderful songs. We've been dancing. It's been wonderful to see so much joy here. And I was talking to an elderly gentleman, Ted, and he said that what is so fabulous about coming here and why it's so important for him is that it puts a smile on his wife's face. And I just thought that was a wonderful comment, which summed up this event. We've had a great time. We've been singing along and dancing to some great songs by the Drifters, the Proclaimers, all the classics. But as I've been talking to the pensioners and older people here, while there is joy to be at the Memory Cafe, there is actually deep worry as well about what's ahead. We are in this cost of living crisis. Everything is going up. The prices in the shops are going up. Filling up the car with petrol is going up. People are desperately worried about the big increases that are coming in the heating bills. People are really wondering how on earth they're going to afford heating bills. I mean, already pensioners are cutting back. Already pensioners are struggling, and we know bigger increases are on the way. And of course, we've also got, because Rishi Sunak and Boris Johnson broke their promise to pensioners on the triple lock, we've now got the biggest real terms cut to the pension in 50 years. This is a staggering, severe cut. And when you think about 500,000 pensioners across Yorkshire, that is going to cause huge damage across the Yorkshire area, across the different parts of Yorkshire. Pensioners, retirees are really going to struggle, as indeed are working families, those in work, because we know that wages are not keeping up with the pace and rise of the cost of living. If you're on universal credit, real deep cuts coming to universal credit as well. There's some of the policy wonks did an analysis of Rishi Sunak's mini budget last week, and they crunched the numbers, and because of decisions that the government are making, 1.3 million people will be pushed into poverty. Many pensioners across Yorkshire pushed into poverty. Nationwide, 500,000 children pushed into poverty. Many of those will be in Yorkshire. I don't think that's a price worth paying, frankly. Rishi Sunak, he's a Yorkshire MP, apparently does think that's a price worth paying. Well, I think he's wrong, and I think he should have done something to support pensioners, families and children in Yorkshire.
I guess the obvious next question is, what would Labour be doing differently? Because I think it's fair to say Rishi Sunak's defence, if you will, of the spring statement was, well, we've got to balance the books, the country's seeing the cost of borrowing go up, etc., etc. So what would Labour do differently, and how would you pay for it?
Well, I mean, Rishi Sunak's putting up tax on people across Yorkshire, including pensioners. If they are working, yeah, if they are in work, they will start paying and if their earnings are such, they will start paying the health and care levy element of the national insurance increase. And this national insurance increase is a very punishing tax rise for working people across Yorkshire. I think there have been 15 tax rises under Rishi Sunak, equating to around £3,000 per household. He is Mr. Tax. He is the tax rising chancellor. He's trying to say people can take this pain now. Children in Yorkshire can go into poverty. Pensioners in Yorkshire can go into poverty in order to give him the room to cut income tax in 2 years' time, even though that income tax cut nowhere near offsets the very big punishing tax rises he's put in place. So what would Labour do? Well, Labour would have a completely different approach. First of all, the reason Rishi Sunak has to raise all these taxes is because for 12 years under the Conservatives now, they've hacked away at the drivers of economic growth. Our economic growth is anemic. So you need a big plan to get your economy growing, to bring the quality, well-paid jobs to Yorkshire that we need, to invest in our industries in Yorkshire, to invest in modern manufacturing in Yorkshire. That's the first thing we will do. But in the here and now, we wouldn't have gone ahead with that national insurance rise, and we would have imposed a windfall tax on these big gas and oil producers who are making absolutely billions of pounds. We'd have used that money to give people across Yorkshire help with their heating bills, to bring their heating bills down. And thirdly, on the issue around the universal credit cuts and the pension cuts, that in some ways is a quirk because and it gets a little bit technical, but the point is this: the reason the pension and universal credit credit is being cut in real terms is because Rishi Sunak and Boris Johnson have pegged it to where inflation was last September. So what you could do is you could say, well, look, inflation is going to be higher this year, so why don't we bring forward some of next year's increase into universal credit and the pension now? The fact that Rishi Sunak didn't do that is bewildering. It's either callousness, incompetence, or he may well be because he's not going to honour his promise to raise the pension and raise universal credit in line with inflation next year. Perhaps that's what's actually going on. But you could bring some of that forward to cushion people as they have to navigate this big stormy and these big waves that are coming through the cost of living crisis.
So one thing I'm really interested in, because obviously you've been here today talking to pensioners, I imagine that as part of your job, you're talking to lots of different pensioners across the country. How aware are they of this specific issue of pensions not rising in line kind of with the real terms inflation?
People are desperately aware. Pensioners are desperately aware. And you know something, right? Look, there's a sort of, and things like this have felt quite strongly in cities like Sheffield, as I was finding out. Look, people remember Mrs. Thatcher breaking the earnings limit with pensions back in the 80s. And that took years and years and years for pensioners to be, again, lifted out of poverty with their extra support because of that decision. This cut to the breaking of the triple lock is, I think, as devastating and as a bigger betrayal as when Margaret Thatcher broke the earnings link in the early 80s. Pensioners know what is coming. And as I was talking to people here, as they were pointing out to me, they've paid their stamps. They've paid their national insurance contributions. They did the right thing. Many of them, throughout their working lives, paid contributions. Many of those pensioners, if they took time out of work because of caring responsibilities, if you're a mother, because what happens is, or what was supposed to happen, is if you took time out of work, you would get national insurance stamps either through your husband's contributions, or when child benefit came in, you'd get a contribution to national insurance through that as well. So people feel they've built up a pot of money that they can draw upon and that the government should honour. But the government is actually cutting their pension in real terms. And many people there are really, really worried and scared about how they're going to survive financially these next 12 months. As I say, Rishi Sunak's doing this, I believe, because on the one hand, he wants to try and appeal to Tory MPs in order to get their votes in a leadership contest. And he thinks that if he could cut income tax by a penny in the run-up to a general election, that will help them electorally. I actually think if you're a Tory MP in Yorkshire, I think Rishi Sunak's rather insulted you, because he's saying to you that all you care about is a penny off income tax, that you don't care about the desperate poverty that we're going to see in your constituency, whether that's in Keighley or Dewsbury or Pudsey or Penistone or Rother Valley, all these seats which went Conservative. So Rishi Sunak's saying to those Conservative MPs, oh, I don't think you care about poverty, I think you only care about tax cuts. Well, I think those Conservative MPs should actually say, well, that's rather, you know, we're better than this. And they should force Rishi Sunak to change course. They should stand up for their constituents. They should stand up for pensioners in Rother Valley, in Don Valley, for pensioners in Penistone, for pensioners in Keighley and Dewsbury and Colne Valley and Calder Valley, they should speak up and stand up for those pensioners, not betray them.
What would you say, though, to the counter-argument that, in theory, what's happening at the moment is trying to right the ship of the public finances after kind of the massive hit of COVID, and the idea that we could, you know, that pensions can rise in line with inflation, that, you know, across the country everyone's wage rises should rise in line with inflation, isn't realistic and maybe can't be achieved.
But the problem with that point is that at the moment, at least, penciled into the Treasury's own calculations are these inflation increases next year. Now, unless he's going to break that, and he may well be planning to break that promise, he just doesn't want to tell us. But at the moment, that's penciled in. Mm. So he could bring it forward from next year, if you like. So, but at the moment, that's penciled in. The second thing is, in the budget of November, the budget that took the decision to break the triple lock, and it took £5 billion off pensioners breaking the triple lock. That's how much he took. It's in black and white in the budget's red book. That was the same budget which, while breaking the triple lock and taking £5 billion off pensioners, gave away over £5 billion in a tax cut on the banker's bonus levy, and indeed a tax cut on things like sparkling wine. So if you're a banker drinking Prosecco, you've got or even something more expensive, you've got a tax cut, while at the same time pensioners were losing £5 billion. So I don't buy this argument, there's no money. What there isn't is the political will from Boris Johnson and Rishi Sunak.
Could I ask, because you kind of took up this brief last year, and since then, the cost of living crisis has kind of exploded in public consciousness, really, but it's now the dominant political issue. Before that, you were Shadow Health Secretary, where obviously COVID was absolutely dominant, every element really of our life. So have you found the change? Were you expecting things to get a bit quieter in the DWP?
I mean, honestly, I went from 2 years from responding to COVID. I remember, funnily enough, back in sort of early January of 2020, reading in the newspapers about this curious pneumonia that had been identified in Wuhan. And I remember thinking, I wonder if this is going to be like swine flu, because I worked in government, Gordon Brown's government, and I was thinking, I wonder if this is going to be like swine flu. And I immediately asked for a briefing from Chris Whitty, Chief Medical Officer, and started discussing it with them. And of course, as January moved into February and so on, we'd begun to see how serious the pandemic was becoming. And that dominated the next 2 years, and I was working on that flat out. The early things we did back in March is that I went into Downing Street to meet Boris Johnson, Chris Whitty, Dominic Cummings for a discussion about restrictions. It wasn't necessarily obvious at that point that the restrictions that were going to be in place would end up being so severe and so extensive. But nonetheless, we understood that some forms of restrictions were necessary. And I basically said to Boris Johnson in his study, look, we're prepared to support restrictions in the national interest, but you've got to do something for working people whose finances are going to be hit. You've got to look at some sort of financial support. You've got to look at sick pay as well. And from those discussions, and I had also had similar discussions directly with Matt Hancock, we won statutory sick pay from day one. So now, the level of sick pay was never enough, in my view, and still isn't enough. But nonetheless, we won statutory sick pay from day one if you caught COVID. The government have now abandoned that, and you don't get statutory sick pay from, you cannot apply for statutory sick pay until day three of your sickness, which means you won't get it until day four. I think that's a huge mistake, particularly when we're in a cost of living crisis. But it is sort of, yes, I've gone from being working flat out on the pandemic for the best part of 2 years to now working flat out, fighting for pensioners, fighting for families, for disabled people who are seeing these real terms cuts and are struggling with this cost of living crisis. It is like, I am pretty full on. That is true.
Can I ask, what's it like dealing with those different challenges? There is, like you've just said, there is obviously some crossover, probably quite a lot of crossover between the two areas, but what did you kind of learn from the COVID pandemic experience, and how is that informing what you're doing now on cost of living?
Well, I think the COVID pandemic experience is, there is a connection. What the COVID experience brought into sharp focus was something that we all intuitively know anyway, which is if you're in poverty and deprivation, you are likely to be hit hardest by illnesses. Sadly, you are likely to become sick sooner in life and even die before others in life. And that is very true in parts of Yorkshire, in parts of South Yorkshire, particularly in parts of West Yorkshire, particularly some of these post-industrial areas, former coalfield areas, where unfortunately those areas are still blighted by higher than average levels of cardiovascular disease, hypertension, heart disease, and mental illness as well. It was people who were poorer, who had no option but to go to work because they didn't have the advantage of sitting on Zoom calls from a laptop in their kitchen. It was people who were poorer, who perhaps living in overcrowded housing, who struggled to get by, for whom COVID was attacked them severely. And when you look at the statistics, it's often poorer people who are more likely to be admitted to hospital and sadly more likely to die. Again, we are now in this crisis, and again, it is the poorer and those struggling to get by who are being hit hardest. We've had one massive cut to Universal Credit before Christmas, £20 reduction per week. We're now getting the second cut to Universal Credit in real terms, the second cut within 6 months. Older people and pensioners whose quality of life was dramatically impacted by COVID. Many of them couldn't leave the house. Many of them sadly deteriorated and faded away in care homes and because they were trapped in their homes throughout that COVID period. And now those older people are facing these very, very deep cuts in the value of the pension, and in turn are struggling to keep their heads above water, and they're really, 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 really scared. So the big lesson throughout the COVID period and this cost of living crisis is the government is letting down the poorest and those on the lower middle incomes. They are bearing the brunt. They bore the brunt of the COVID crisis. They're now bearing the brunt of this cost of living crisis. I don't think that's right. Because the reason I'm in politics, the reason I'm a Labour politician, is because I don't fundamentally believe that poverty and deprivation and disadvantage are self-correcting. I believe that a child born into Sheffield, a child born into Barnsley, a child born into Huddersfield should have the same life chances as a child born in the wealthy parts of the country. Now, I grew up in Manchester, in Salford. I'm from the other side of the Pennines, although I ended up in the Midlands as a Leicester MP, because that's where life took me. But there's lots of things in common between growing up in, being born in Salford and growing up in Manchester and areas in South Yorkshire. And those injustices and those unfairnesses in life are what motivate me and what I'm passionate about.
You spoke movingly, actually, before Christmas. I think it was an article in the Daily Mirror about your experiences of growing up in single-parent household in the 1980s and 1990s and how sometimes it'd be quite a struggle for your mum to pay the bills. And one thing that I was wondering was, how different is it nowadays? Have things improved or have things got even worse for people who are in your mum's position, kind of compared to what it was then?
Well, I think everybody's struggling. Everyone's hard up. Everybody's skinned at the moment. And that's why I'm so angry about the mini budget last week. Rishi Sunak did so little to help people who were really struggling to keep their head above water. I was just talking to a man here who said that the food bank in this area has gone from servicing 150 people to now servicing thousands of people. I mean, that just shows you the level of need. And I think, although in the 80s and 90s, lone parent employment was lower than it is today, even though we've got more lone parents in work, the deal, which was always supposed to be, if you get a job, if you get a paycheck, you won't be in poverty, that deal has collapsed. Because people in work are in poverty. You know, most of the children growing up in poverty have a parent in work. And when you go to food banks, as I do, it's often people on the way back from a shift, even though they're working all hours cut sends, they're still struggling, who are picking up food parcels to feed their family. Look, I went to a food bank in my own Leicester constituency, and I heard the story of a woman who was given some fresh food, and she said, oh, I'm going to have to switch the fridge on now.
Wow.
But she's not had the fridge plugged in because she cannot afford the electricity bills. I mean, this is what is going on in our society at the moment. And it's going to get worse because of the decisions that were taken last week by Rishi Sunak. 1.3 million people extra in poverty. So some things have improved, but the old deal, the old guarantee that you get yourself a job, you'll get yourself a wage, a paycheck, and you'll be better off, that is breaking down. People are in poverty even though they're in work. This, the way in which we run our economy has got to be upended. We've got to invest again in good, good wages, good skilled jobs, and good manufacturing jobs. Because this economy, characterised by low pay, temporary work, 0 hours contracts, is making people poorer. That cannot be right.
Can I ask, you briefly touched on it earlier, that when you worked for Gordon Brown in government, you've been a Labour MP since 2011. All of that period has been in opposition. I mean, do you see a path back to power for Labour?
Yes, I do. I hate opposition. I absolutely hate it. I was talking today to a man diagnosed with dementia in his 50s. He can get no support from the social security system because the assessment system doesn't understand or recognise what living with dementia in your 50s means. Even though you can't use a cooker, the system thinks, well, you can put a frozen meal in a microwave, you can look after yourself. Even though he ought to get extra support with his mobility and so on, even though he's got dementia, the system won't give it him. That is a heartbreaking story. And when we know that 1 in 3 people born this year will go on to develop dementia, that means more and more people will be, sadly, unless we find cures and therapies, and one of the last things I did as Shadow Health Secretary was announce that a Labour government would invest more in dementia research. But unless we find cures and therapies, more and more people will have dementia in society, and more people will be diagnosed with dementia in their 40s and their 50s. The point of this story is that we have an assessment system in the social security system that simply does not recognise or appreciate or have any sympathy for the fact that people in their 40s and 50s are getting dementia, and it's giving them no help. That gentleman's story was heartbreaking. He's living off his savings and trying to get by, even though he has dementia and obviously had to leave the world of work. And the reason I hate being in opposition is because all I can do in opposition is offer that man my sympathies, offer that man my commitment that I'll speak out about it, offer my man my promise that one day I will hopefully be able to do something about it. Until I get into government, I cannot do anything about it. That is why the Labour Party has got to get into government now. Do I see a path? Yes, I do. Because I think for the first time in a long time, I think Labour's prospects are improving. But I also know that we've got to work hard to convince the British people, to convince people across Yorkshire, in all those constituencies that fell dramatically in Yorkshire in 2019, and actually we lost a lot of them in 2010 as well, but there was a real falling off a cliff in 2019. I know we've got to work really hard to win the trust of people again, to reassure them that we can make a difference. But also, I do pick this up as I'm going around, not just Yorkshire, but the Midlands and to Manchester. I do think people are asking themselves, what have they got after 12 years of Conservative government? You know, you've got 12 years of the Tories, and taxes are so high and so punishing, public services so incredibly stretched, growth is so anemic, employment is not providing the well-paid jobs that people want. So what's happened after 12 years of Conservative government? It's 12 wasted years that have got us into this mess.
But as you said yourself, 2019 was a particularly devastating result for Labour. what do you kind of attribute that to? Because it isn't an easy turnaround from the position the party's at the moment.
Well, people didn't trust us. People didn't trust us. They didn't think our offer was credible, nor did they have confidence in the candidate we had for Prime Minister. I mean, that's, you don't even need to look at the opinion polls and all of that. But we have a new leader now who is working hard to listen to people and to speak up on behalf of them and their concerns. And crucially, our team of Keir, of Rachel Reeves and Angela Rayner, our top team, are putting together, and I'm obviously part of that in my portfolio as well, we're putting together a set of policies which we believe will meet the needs of the British people and Yorkshire, and the needs of the people in Yorkshire, both in terms of bringing back good jobs, bringing back good manufacturing jobs, investing in our research base here, but also supporting our pensioners and retirees across Yorkshire, doing more to support children. I mean, children across Yorkshire, like everywhere, have lost the best part of 2 terms worth of education. There are big issues facing the country which are holding this country back. I believe the Labour team will put forward a set of policies that will meet the needs of the future for Yorkshire and the country. But we've got to get out there and we've got to make the arguments and we've got to listen to people as well. We've got to persuade people.
That's great. I've just got one final question. Yeah. I'm slightly reluctant to ask this now that you said how much you hate opposition. But I was just wondering, what campaign since you've been an MP have you got any particular pride in or look back on? Because I obviously take the point about it is tricky in opposition to make a difference.
Two issues. The first issue was a constituency issue where a single mother approached me who was in the most dire circumstances with the finances and the social security system were not giving her the entitlements to which she was due, and she was, her children were in desperate need. She approached me and we looked into it and we fought her corner and we won it for her. I met that single mother 2 or 3 years later, maybe 4 or 5 years later. You've been an MP for over 10 years, sometimes these things slightly blur. The point is, I met the mother sometime down the line. She said to me, she bumped into me and she said, do you remember me? And I said, yeah. She said, you helped me, and because you helped me, my daughter, who is now 21, so it must have been about 5 or 6 years, because the daughter was a teenager. But because you helped me, I was able to provide more for my daughter. She got to university, and she's now in the civil service, and she's actually just been seconded into Downing Street as civil servant. And she said, that's because of your help and, you know, helping me get the money to be able to provide for my daughter properly. I'm sure it's not because of that. I'm sure there's lots of other reasons why that very talented, impressive young woman got that opportunity. But it just struck me that even though no one necessarily shouts about it, MPs can make a tremendous difference. The second thing, which I'm very proud of, is that I spoke out in very personal terms about my father's drink problem. My dad sadly was an alcoholic, not to put too hard a point on it, and indeed died as a result of his drinking at 60. And that is obviously something which coloured my life, has impacted every aspect of my life. It's, I think, something I think about deeply often, the days when I was with my dad and he was just drunk and I had to go to the shops to fill the fridge because the food, because all that was in it was bottles of white wine and cans of lager. And just dealing with my dad when he was drunk. I spoke out in very personal terms in a way in which I wasn't expecting to do. It was a speech on alcohol abuse. And I was speaking in the debate as the Shadow Health Secretary, and I had a very sort of detailed policy-based speech. And I actually threw the speech away and just spoke and gave my own testimony.
So it was the spur of the moment, was it?
Yeah,
almost?
I thought, sod it. I'm going to say this. The minister was crying in response to me. And then, in fairness to Jeremy Hunt, who was the health secretary at the time, he got in touch with me and said, look, maybe can we do something together on supporting children of alcoholics? And I went to see him and he agreed that he would invest some money in charity project and a charity helpline for children who are impacted by parental drinking. And so we won some money, millions of pounds, and different children's charities won money, some money. I'm sure there'll no doubt some charities across Yorkshire won it, got some of that pot of money. To provide support, to provide helplines for the children impacted by parental drinking. And there's a charity that I've supported who I've run three London marathons for, called NACOA, who won a phone line. They could tell them was heartbreaking stories of children ringing them on Christmas Day, or children ringing them for a bedtime story, you know, hiding under the bed because their parents are so drunk or being violent, and they just want somebody to talk to down the phone. They will read bedtime stories or they'll support on Christmas Day. So I've run three London marathons for this charity, the NACOA, National Association of Children and Alcoholics. But with Jeremy Hunt, we won some money to give different charities like that money to do the support. And actually, me and Jeremy Hunt did a joint press release. Him as the government minister, me as the shadow health secretary. We did a joint interview together as well. So I'm immensely proud of being able to make a difference to some children's lives. Although I should say that in doing this joint interview together, we stood on College Green outside the House of Commons. And of course, I am relatively short, at 5'7". Jeremy Hunt is very tall, he's way over 6 foot. And the two of us are doing this interview together. And it was a bit like, it was only two of us, it wasn't three of us. But do you remember that famous sort of two Ronnies and John Cleese moment? Where I looked down on him, and it felt like that. So we did look slightly ridiculous with this. But the height difference was just did make us like difference. Ridiculous, but you say, can you make a difference? You can make a difference, but that's what I've done from opposition. But my God, we can do so much more if as a government.
Well, look, I think that's a fantastic point to leave it on. Thank you so, so much for your time. It's been absolutely wonderful speaking to you. Really appreciate it.
Thank you.
Thank you for listening to this week's episode of Pod's Own Country. If you have any topics you think we should be covering or any stories you think we should be digging into, please get in touch with me via email, chris.byrne@jpimedia.co.uk. Speak next week.